to New Books in World Affairs. This is your host, Christian Peterson, and today I have the good fortune of speaking with General Daniel Bulger about his new book, Why We Lost, A General's Inside Account of the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars, which is put out by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishers. General Bulger, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much, Christian. Good to be here.
Before we begin, would you like to give our listeners a bit of a short history of your background?
Sure. My background, I spent 35 years in the United States Army. My background was infantry, ground combat, and I completed my service during the current war. I served in Iraq twice, once as a one-star brigadier general commanding an advisory element to the Iraqi armed forces, and then the second time as a two-star general commanding the 1st Cavalry Division in Baghdad. And then I followed that up as a three-star general, lieutenant general, commanding our advisory effort in Afghanistan from 2011 to 13. And following that final duty position, I retired from the service, and now I teach college at North Carolina State University.
How is it making that transition? I mean, not so much in terms of, you know, the obvious differences, but getting back into academia. How have you found that so far? Did that take a lot of adjustment, or was it just like, you know, riding a bicycle, kind of getting back into the groove of dealing with students and that sort of stuff, the day-to-day of being a professor?
Yeah, the military is a lot about education and training. And so I had some familiarity. And of course, working with people younger than myself is very common, since the majority of the armed forces are people 18 to 22. Old guys like me, we're kind of thin on the ground by the time you get to my age. So it's some similarities. I mean, young people are young people. I did have the chance earlier in my military service to teach cadets at West Point for 3 years, from 86 to 89. And so you're right. I mean, I was familiar with how you teach college. And of course, I went there myself a million years ago, but not West Point, but college, that is. I think, you know, some similarities, but no doubt, I think the best part about it is getting to work with the students, and they ask great questions, and they're all eager to learn about, you know, history, which is what I teach.
Yeah, I find that too, teaching my undergraduates, a lot of interest in military history. I mean, we keep getting students at my university wondering, why don't we have more military history classes, and sometimes the academy doesn't seem to be moving in that direction of teaching more military history, even though there's quite a lot of interest for it.
Yeah, no, and I credit North Carolina State University. They've consistently offered a good range of courses in all aspects of history. I was fortunate to come in right when the previous fellow retired that was teaching the military history, so timing was good, and I picked it up and done my best with that. And I think the students and I are both getting some out of it.
Yeah, it sounds great. As far as your book, you divide your arguments into three sections, and I think it works very well. I think the easiest way to go about it would to start with part one and kind of lead up to, you know, the two wars that you talk about. You spend the beginning of part one, and it's part of this is in the, you know, the preface and in the beginning, dealing with the harbingers, the kind of what the events of the 1990s, starting with the Gulf War, and then, you know, some of the attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa and the attack on the USS Cole. I was wondering what, you know, lessons were learned or not learned, or how it, you know, either impacted or didn't impact the minds of, you know, of military leadership in this country as they, you know, look toward, you know, the year 2000 and beyond.
Well, I think there's no doubt that what happened in the 90s, beginning with our efforts against Iraq in 1990-91 to liberate Kuwait and fight the forces of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that's really where the United States, in a major way, put forces into that region. We'd had a long involvement there, of course, going back, decades, but that's where we made a major entry. And of course, we had a very successful war to liberate Kuwait, you know, from a military standpoint, defeated Saddam Hussein's army and air force and successfully freed Kuwait and returned it to the control of the Emir and the people of Kuwait. But it did leave a lot of questions. And among those were the questions in the minds of our enemies. In the case of the Iraqis, they clearly wondered, you know, what they'd done wrong, what they would do different if they had to fight us the next time. And then there were also the Saudis, the people in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabian people, Among them, a contractor named Osama bin Laden, who was very frustrated with the fact that a large number of Westerners, led by the Americans in force, you know, almost a million people by the time he added in all the contractors and everybody else that came in 1991, that had entered Saudi Arabia, that were clearly almost all of them not believers, not Muslims. And Saudi Arabia, of course, is the centerpiece of the Islamic religion, you know, the great cities of Mecca and Medina that were central to the story of the Prophet Muhammad and to that faith. And so bin Laden was outraged that the Saudi government, you know, the king allowed us in to liberate Kuwait, to defend Saudi Arabia. And he, that's what was a formative event for him. Coupled with his previous experience fighting the Russians in Afghanistan, those two things together encouraged him to declare war against the United States. And the things you've talked about were his attempts in the 1990s to basically prosecute that war. In 1998, he attacked our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania with some effect. I mean, killed dozens of people and a lot of local people, almost hundreds of local people. And then compounded that in October 2000 when he attacked the USS Cole, a guided missile destroyer that was taking on fuel in the port of Aden, which is near the southern end of the Red Sea. And he made those, you know, his teams made those attacks and at the same time staged for what we would know as the 9/11, September 11, 2001 airliner attacks. They were preparing all of these. And that was bin Laden's way. His goal of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, which is Arabic for the base or the foundation, his goal was essentially to draw the United States into Afghanistan into a long, indecisive war, a stalemated war, and cause us to experience an internal breakup, as that was his view of what had happened to the Soviet Union. In the mind of bin Laden, that reflected divine intervention on behalf of the believers of Islam. But there was certainly no doubt that it had an effect in world politics that led to problems within the Soviet Union. It was certainly not the only cause of the Soviet Union's demise, but it was a factor.
Sure, and it's a nice segue into my next question. You make the point very well that Osama bin Laden did not think Americans, you know, could take casualties, that they wanted to get them into a bleeding war that would, you know, weaken them, and it kind of, you know, the 9/11 attacks were carried out for that. In your estimation, and you obviously address this in the book, you know, and you can use this, I think, as a platform to kind of, we can begin to go through your larger arguments about what went right and what went wrong with the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan as part of its larger effort to, you know, take out the Taliban and, you know, take out al-Qaeda as part of, you know, this George Bush's, you know, global war on terrorism. How do you think, you know, like I said, what went right and what went wrong with, you know, the U.S. Initial focus on Afghanistan after 9/11?
Well, it's interesting that when after 9/11 occurred, the initial discussions within our government, you know, the various intelligence and law enforcement sources came in and tried to identify who had done it. It was suspected right away it was al-Qaeda. The Central Intelligence Agency, Military Intelligence Services had been tracking them and knew that they were behind the Cole attack and the embassy attacks in Africa. And they had certainly, you know, followed Osama bin Laden. There had even been an attempt in 98 using cruise missiles to knock out his camps in Afghanistan and to even try and get him. That was unsuccessful, although some damage was done to the camps. So there was a feeling right away that al-Qaeda was behind it, not a feeling, a thought, you know, a pretty clear set of facts that led the intel services to say, yeah, this is the guy who did it. But almost immediately, there was also discussion in the U.S. government of, you know, okay, what else is behind this? And it led President Bush very early on, in fact, on the night of September 11th, to talk in terms of a military operation versus a law enforcement or intelligence effort that would have, the Clinton administration certainly did military operations. So did President Bush's father, the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush. But they preferred to use more of a mix of law enforcement, intel work, working with allies, and not, you know, declare war, if you will. In the case of Bush, though, he the younger Bush, President Bush, President number 43 Bush, George W. Bush, he and his administration said, no, we're going to treat this as a military event. And the night of the attack, when he addressed the nation, he said, we're going to make no distinction between the terrorists and those who harbor them. That was an important point, because up until then, we had focused on Al-Qaeda, which was the guys who attacked us, and you know, then on September 11th, obviously. But they're terror, they were a network of terrorists, and what do we mean when we say that? They're individuals salted around places in Afghanistan. They had some camps and things, but we shouldn't think of it, you know, they're not running the equivalent of Marine boot camp at Camp Lejeune with thousands of people going through training. It was individuals. It was almost like a master apprentice system, you know, and that was the way they were teaching people how to do bombings and how to, you know, hijack aircraft and all that kind of thing. It's small numbers of people, highly selected, working in secret. And to get at that kind of enemy was really, really hard. And so when President Bush turned to the military and said, what can you do about this? The U.S. military, I think, correctly came back and said, we're not very good at manhunting. You know, that's not really what we do. If you want that, you need the FBI or you need police. You know, they are good at finding criminals. We don't do that very well. But if you need us to knock out one of these state supporting countries, well, now you've come to the right place. And in the case of the United States military, we didn't specifically have plans for Afghanistan, but we certainly, you know, we'd made plans for how we might go in and knock out a country or something like that. And we had done it before. We'd done it in 1991 with the Iraqis. We'd done it in Kosovo with the Serbians in 1999. We had taken over Haiti in 1994. So, I mean, we had this ability to go somewhere and do that. And that was the initial state of the planning. You know, it was what could the military do right away to avenge 9/11 and set things up so that perhaps these terrorists of Al-Qaeda could be rounded up and killed, captured, tried, whatever it was they decided to do. But clearly a strong military bent right from the start. And one other thing I'd highlight that you mentioned, very, very important concept, is this idea of global war on terrorism. The global war on terrorism is a generic thing. Terrorism is a tactic used by people, used by enemies in this case, that don't have conventional militaries, that want to strike against countries that are more powerful or distant for political purposes. You know, it's a form of warfare, but in that regard, it's another tool in the capabilities that some entities would use. When Bush said global war on terrorism, it's noteworthy that he did not identify the enemy. It was understood to be Al-Qaeda, but it was left a little bit wide open. I mean, there are many terrorist groups in the world. Many of them have nothing to do with Islam, or if they have something to do with Islam, they have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. And a good number of them have only local interests, you know, I mean, and we can think of some of the well-known ones, you know, Hezbollah that operates out of Lebanon against Israel, or the old Irish Republican Army that used to work in Northern Ireland against the British. I mean, these are terrorist groups, but they have no affiliation with like an international group that had strong fundamentalist Islamic beliefs like Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point you make about it. One of the ideas you keep coming back to throughout the book, and certainly in the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan, is the question of who's the enemy and, you know, what's our goal? Is it, you know, who are we fighting? How are we going to achieve victory? I mean, what your analysis opens up throughout the book is kind of that. I mean, I don't even know where to find it. The line between, you know, effective, you know, war making to make the world safer versus getting drawn into the task of nation building. And that's something that I think has to, you know, you grapple with in the book, especially when you go over how Tommy Franks planned the operation in Enduring Freedom, which starts as, you know, Operation Infinite Justice, I believe.
Was the actual original code name. And the military gets code names two different ways. There's a computer generated list that they're not really nonsense words, but they're essentially just assigned code names. The one that many people have heard that's very famous from history was Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion.
Yes.
You know, and that's one people have heard of before, but, these code names really are usually come off a list. In the old days, it used to be typed up, and then nowadays it's generated by computer. And they'll have a pro word. Nowadays, the pro word will usually say what region it's set in. So there have been previous operations in Afghanistan. One was called Infinite Reach, which was a cruise missile strike program that had been planned and done actually in 98. So Infinite Justice was in that series. It was just, you know, the next one on the list, the words. Well, when they planned it, that this sort of got to a key point here. So they say, okay, we're going to do Operation Infinite Justice. And for those who are interested, there's actually a whole footnote about what I'm about to say in the 9/11 Commission report that explains all this. So this is not some secret thing you can't read about, you know, except in the bowels of the internet. It's readily available. But what's interesting is when they said, okay, we're going to call this Infinite Justice, our allies in the region, the Pakistanis, the Saudis, the Emiratis and the United Arab Emirates, places we were going to stage forces, these are primarily Islamic countries, of course, they said, wait a minute, you know, that's a term that, you know, our people, when they hear that and it gets translated into our language, you know, you're basically taking the role of God here. You know, yeah, we know you're a superpower, but you're not that strong. And so, so we came out, that's where the second way you can generate a military code word, and that is somebody just says, hey, we want a different word. And so instead they came up with the idea of enduring freedom. And that was the code word, the code name then used for the attacks into Afghanistan and still is being used. In fact, that operation's just wrapping up now in December 2014, the combat operations, it's still called Enduring Freedom.
That's true. And I'm trying to, yeah, I read your book and I go back and I, you know, live through it. I'm trying to get a sense of if Bush or the military, you seem to paint very, very well, but if they knew when this would end, what would be, you know, the victory in Afghanistan? Would it be, you know, Al-Qaeda's gone and then you leave the troops out and let the Afghanistan people build their own country? I mean, at what point, it seems to be some people made the argument that the Bush administration could have gotten the troops out relatively quickly. I guess what I'm getting at is at the end of the day, do you think they really, people knew what they were getting into when, you know, after the special forces, you know, go in and then eventually the troop levels are raised?
Well, I don't think they knew what they were getting into. If nothing else, they should have read Osama bin Laden's fatwa, because he said, my goal is to make a big enough attack on the Americans to cause them to commit a bunch of troops to Afghanistan. So in a way, we were doing exactly what our enemy had wanted us to do. We chose a method of attack that was unusual. I mean, we used special operations forces intel, working with local militias, the Northern Alliance most notably, but some other local militias as well. Our very strong air power coming off aircraft carriers, coming off the Air Force bases around the world, including some in the United States that flew all the way from the U.S. to do the missions, you know, using aerial tanking and all that stuff, you know, guided by very high precision, you know, overhead satellites and stuff like that, so we could strike exactly where we wanted. I mean, it was a capability only the United States had, and I don't think bin Laden and his people, and certainly the Taliban, who were his supporters, Mullah Omar and the Taliban government of Afghanistan, I don't think they had any idea that we could mount something like that so quickly. And it even surprised us how quickly it went and how successful it was. But in a way, that sort of created the problem. We had originally, as you pointed out, General Tommy Franks, who was the overall U.S. commander for that phase of the war, he had thought, okay, well, it's going to take a while to take these guys down, and then when we take them down, we'll turn it over to somebody, the U.N., local government, whatever, and we'll pull out and get ready for the next phase, because Bush had said it's a global war on terrorism. And, you know, Al-Qaeda was one phase, but who else was on the chart? There were already people talking about the Iraqis. There was discussion what to do about Iran, you know. It's at one point during the State of the Union message, you know, too, President Bush even inserted North Korea into that list. So, I mean, the thought among the military was, hey, get this done, do it as quickly as you can, and pull everybody out to get ready for the next phase, you know, because it was unclear where we were going to go next, although there were a bunch of options. But because we were so successful, the Afghans, of course, said, hey, we need help setting up our government. Our European allies, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, had for the first time in their history invoked Article 5. That's the article that says an attack on one member is an attack on all. People forget this, but NATO actually sent some aircraft over to support the United States in patrolling our skies after 9/11. They sent some aircraft. The Canadians did as well, because we have a bilateral treaty with them for the defense of North America. And so there were a lot of allies saying, hey, well, you know, now you've done a good knockout in the first round with a little bit of allied help. We'd like to stay and help build this government. You know, we would like your support. And so the U.S. started to back into, as you coined it, and that's correct, nation building. You know, essentially, okay, we've knocked out the Taliban. Now let's help these Afghans get their country on their feet. What we didn't think through was, what will be the effect of having thousands of non-Afghans, thousands of Westerners, thousands of non-Muslims in that country? What would be the effect out in the villages when word got around? You know, how would that play out? And what would happen with the Taliban remnants out there? Well, as it turned out, that was a recruiting tool, because they said, they said, hey, you know, the infidels are here to take our country. Let's rally around them. And the one thing that all Afghans can agree on, they don't agree on much, but they sure don't like outsiders trying to take over their country.
That's true. It's a really important point. A couple other questions I have related to the first few years of U.S. and Afghanistan has to deal with an incident that I don't think many of our readers would know about, but you devote considerable attention in the book, called the Kuala-i-Jangi uprising that had to do with the prison revolt.
Kuala-i-Jangi prison.
Yes, yeah. I think that would, something I haven't read about that widely in the literature, but I think you do a great job describing it to the general reader.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. It happened early in the war. It happened in November. You know, 9/11 occurred here, September 11th. By October 7th, we're operating in Afghanistan, fighting them. And then in November, just around Thanksgiving time, we had taken the capital of Kabul. We were marching on the rest of the country, you know, mainly in the south, which is where the Taliban originated. The Afghanistan is made up of a bunch of different ethnic groups, but the largest one by number is the Pashtuns. They're maybe about 40% or so of the country, and they live in the south and the east. So that's where the Taliban was strong. They were strong among the Pashtuns. Our allies from the Northern Alliance were primarily people from two other ethnic groups, the Tajiks and the Uzbeks. And as we took Pashtun captives, we had to put them somewhere. We had only a few small special forces teams, and of course they can't stop and guard these guys because they're out on operations. And the Air Force, who's flying missions, and the Navy off the carriers and all that, well, you know, you can't really guard them with planes. And so the Northern Alliance says, we'll take care of these prisoners. We'll watch them for you. And they centralized them in a place up in northern Iraq called Kuala-i-Jangi. And to an American, it would look like it's a big fort. It looks like Fort McHenry in Baltimore or you know, Fort Sumter in Charleston. It's an old style fort just like that, like almost like a castle. And they put these guys in there. But what they didn't think through was what would happen when you put all these people in there. Because talk about not thinking things through. Kuala-i-Jangi, before it was a prisoner camp, was an arms depot. And the Afghans thought it through so poorly that the arms were still in there. And they put the prisoners in on top of the arms.
Incredible.
Now, you know, we laugh about that. We say, yeah, crazy. But in their mind, they were trying very quickly to improvise. I mean, they were worried about taking over the rest of the country. They were worried about keeping up with the American Air Force, all this other stuff. So it was done as an afterthought. And at that point, the U.S. said, hey, we better send some guys into this prison and ask any of these people if they know where bin Laden was. I mean, that's how weak our intelligence was on Al-Qaeda at the time. We actually sent people into the prison to sort of, you know, do a survey, you know, almost like a Oprah show or something, go around with a microphone. Who here has ever met Osama bin Laden? And I mean, it wasn't quite that amateurish, but it was really weak compared to how we would do it later. And so when our people went into the prison, the prisoners revolted. I mean, when they saw the Americans, they reacted strongly. They grabbed the weapons, and there was an uprising. And us and the members of the Northern Alliance, using U.S. air power, had to put that uprising down. It's noteworthy because the first American killed in the Afghan operation was killed at Kuala-i-Jangi, and it's a fellow named Mike Spann. He was a Central Intelligence Agency officer, a former Marine. He was the first American killed in the military side of this war in Afghanistan, and he was killed during the uprising, which was put down using U.S. airstrikes and all that, and the prisoners were eventually properly processed. Some of them actually went to Guantanamo, which is still being used as a prison today.
Yes, I didn't know much about this moment of the war at all before I read your book, so it was very interesting to read. And another issue that I think our listeners would very much benefit from you weighing in on is the debate about whether the U.S. government and military let Osama bin Laden get away when it had him surrounded at Tora Bora, or in that, you know, as the Taliban fled into, or you know, members of Al-Qaeda fled into Pakistan. What's your analysis of that debate about whether he was lost or not?
Well, As mentioned at the prison, we were going in there trying, who's seen bin Laden? I mean, bin Laden was on the run as soon as the airstrikes started. And the region, the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is very mountainous. The Hindu Kush Mountains there, second highest range in the world after the Himalayas. I mean, very, very tough terrain. And of course, now it's November, December, so the weather's bad. You got snow in the passes. You've got howling winds. Very difficult to get aircraft in. Even our all-weather jets have trouble getting into that type of environment to drop bombs or to look for people using cameras and stuff. So very tough weather, and they're moving on foot. They're moving with donkeys and small vehicles, you know, Toyota pickup trucks, trying to get across the border into Pakistan, which they hope will be safe for them. And this place that you described, Tora Bora, sometimes called the White Mountains, it was a complex that Bin Laden had built for the Afghan Mujahideen, for the fighters against the Soviets in the war in the 1980s. That's where he'd first gotten his experience, you know, combat experience, was helping them as a contractor, essentially building tunnels. So he knew about this, and he and his key lieutenants went there as soon as the American airstrike started and pulled up, planning to cross the border. And so the United States gets in information, some from the prisoners at Kalajangi, some from other means, and figures out that Osama bin Laden's probably in this Tora Bora region. But that would be the equivalent of saying that, you know, okay, a guy we're looking for is in the Rocky Mountains. You know, I mean, it's a big area. It is very bad terrain, horrible weather. And the United States didn't have that many troops at the time. We had a Marine unit that had just come into southern Iraq. We had a small army unit that did help with Kalajangi, but that was staging out of the north and out of Pakistan. But I'd say as far as troops we could put on the ground, maybe a couple thousand, and that's really stretching it. And that would have left everything else unprotected. And there were ongoing fights going with the remnants of the Taliban in the south and east. But we could have scraped up some troops. The problem is that terrain there is so bad. You would need tens of thousands of troops to cover that border and seal it if you could even do it. And even then, at night in bad weather, they might slip through between. So, because the border, it's not as if there's a border fence. There's no Berlin Wall or anything like that around the border. It's totally open. And all there are some little guard shacks on the Afghan side and on the Pakistan side. So, we thought using local militiamen, some of our special forces, some of our CIA guys, we think we might have cornered Bin Laden. There was a whole debate about, you know, was he there? Was he not there? Then, you know, was he wounded? Was he killed? All that. We didn't really know. And it took, you know, his trail went cold after that for quite a while. You know, we get an occasional tape or something, but there was a whole thought. And within about a year or two, it had coalesced that, well, he was there, but because we didn't seal the border, we didn't get him. But at the time, we weren't really sure he was there. You know, that was hindsight that finally was able to put everything together and say, yeah, he probably was in that area, and yeah, he probably escaped. But I think one important point we should make is that the damage done to Al-Qaeda when they lost their camps and they lost their benefactors in the Taliban that owned the state, they lost essentially their launching pad when they lost that. Al-Qaeda under Bin Laden never really mounted another attack. Elements that claim the name of Al-Qaeda, elements that do things in the spirit of Al-Qaeda, they're certainly out there, and they've been active. I mean, the 7/7 attacks in July of 2005 in Great Britain, the attacks in Spain in 2004 against the trains in Madrid, the attacks in Bali in Indonesia. I mean, these are things by Al-Qaeda affiliates or Al-Qaeda wannabes, whatever you want to call it. I mean, even the Tsarnaev brothers at the Boston Marathon make reference to inspiration from Al-Qaeda. But inspired by is not the same thing as run by. The reality was that Bin Laden, you know, once we knocked out the Taliban and ran him out of the country, he never really got reestablished as the leader of a centralized Al-Qaeda. They never mounted any other major operations. And then, as we know, about 10 years after that, in May of 2011, our special forces got him in Pakistan.
Yes, I mean, that's an interesting take. It's one I hear it in some places, but a lot of people are like, oh, it was a missed moment because we dropped the ball and we started looking. And eventually the argument goes that we started paying too much attention to Iraq, which I think is a good segue into the way you transitioned to part one to part two of your book with the focus on Iraq. My question is,
yeah, we did indeed transfer to our attention to Iraq. That's quite true.
Yes. Leaving aside, you can weigh in if you want about whether the U.S. should have invaded Iraq or not. But every time I read about accounts of the U.S. preparing for the war, it often comes back to the name Don Rumsfeld, and how he kind of influenced the American approach to the war, the way that the invasion was carried out. I guess my question is, you know, how did you, you know, what was your understanding or view of how Rumsfeld handled the invasion and the actual plan as it was carried out?
Well, there's an old line. They often blame us guys in uniform, especially us generals, say, well, you know, generals are always willing to fight the last war. When you refer to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, in a way, he was willing to fight the last war, too, in Iraq. But the last war he was willing to fight was what he'd seen in Afghanistan. That highly unusual combination of local forces, special ops units, intel agencies, air power, encouraged Secretary Rumsfeld to believe that the right way to go into Iraq was with the smallest possible armed force you could use. Now, the United States at 9/11, you know, I mentioned we didn't really have a specific, you know, big time plan for Afghanistan. We had plans for like cruise missile strikes and all that we've been running, but that was not one of the countries we normally planned to fight in or fight against. But there were two countries in the world that we had planned since the early 90s that we might have to fight in. One of them is kind of obvious, and that's Korea, because of the North-South Korea split. And if you'll remember, in the 90s, there was all kinds of problems with the North Koreans with nuclear weapons and all this kind of stuff. So the possibility of a war on the Korean Peninsula at that time was one of the two major contingencies the U.S. prepared for. The other one was a renewed fight in Iraq, Kuwait area. You know, the thought that Saddam may regroup his army and march south into Kuwait again. And so when the planners in the military, you know, were told, hey, I think we're going to have to do something against Iraq. Well, they were very happy because if nothing else, they had a plan for that. We'd rehearsed it. We practiced it. We'd even run through it once in 1991. But the 1991 plan, you know, was 500,000 Americans. And back to Secretary Rumsfeld, he said, oh, you don't need that many. Look, we just took down Iraq with a couple hundred guys on horseback with radios talking to the Air Force. You know, figure out a way to do this with a lot less people. Okay, well, you know, here we get a split, because you can knock out the Iraqi armed forces pretty quickly. They weren't that competent, and our guys fight better, and we have a lot more firepower and intel and all that. So, you know, we're much better than them in a qualitative sense. What they didn't think through is the fact that if you don't send in enough Americans, you don't really control the country. You don't really get out to all the corners of the country, and somebody's going to fill that power vacuum. And we didn't think through who that somebody might be. Now, I will credit one person. I mentioned him in the book. He has been mentioned, and this poor guy gets beat up a lot because of his tenure as the Secretary for the Veterans Administration, and that's General Retired Rick Shinseki. He was the chief of staff of the Army at the time of the Iraq invasion. And in testimony to Congress, when he was pressed, he didn't offer it, but when he was pressed, somebody said, well, you know, what's it really going to take to control Iraq? And he said several hundred thousand troops. And Rumsfeld and Secretary Rumsfeld's deputy, Paul Wolfowitz at the Pentagon, they both threw water on that. They said, no way. No, this guy's way out of line. Well, it turned out General Shinseki, who fought and been badly wounded in Vietnam, who'd served in the Balkans with our peacekeeping forces, he was just about right on target. And we eventually did have to build up to that large force. But at the time we did, there was a full-scale insurgency underway in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to belabor the point, but especially when you look back at it now and you see Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz too, for that matter, it was how should I put this? Arrogance and contempt for that kind of argument. I mean, Wolfowitz, I remember one in an interview when someone asked him if the United States was going to have hundreds of thousands of troops. He literally looked at the interviewer like she was the stupidest person on the planet for even raising the point. In retrospect, as you said, it was completely appropriate line of questioning and concern to have.
Yeah. Well, he actually thought we'd be greeted as liberators. And we were in some regions, but the majority of the country did not greet us as liberators. The Kurds were suspicious because they felt like we hadn't done enough to help them in 1991. The Shia Arabs in the south were highly suspicious because they felt like we'd encouraged them to revolt in 1991 and then gave them no support at all. So you go into a country where a good chunk of the population, about two-thirds of the population, suspicious, and one-third, the Sunni Arabs who supported Saddam, they're active enemies. And that's the world you're going into. This is not, you know, the liberation of France in 1944 by any means.
No, not at all. And it raises a good point. I think it's a good segue into Paul Bremer's decision to issue order number one. In retrospect, is that a bad idea? Is it a good idea at the time? I mean, and how do you evaluate that moment? And
well, not thought through very well. There was, you know, General Tommy Franks was still the overall commander for the region. He had not thought through the aftermath, he and his people, but of course the commander's always responsible, and I know that because it's certainly been me in some of these operations. Hadn't thought through the aftermath in Afghanistan, but got over with that because the Taliban fled, Bin Laden fled, and things quieted down there. In the case of Iraq, they also had not thought through very well. Well, what happens if we're wildly successful and we march to Baghdad and Saddam's deposed, then what? Well, there was sort of this vague, you know, well, the UN will come in. Well, maybe some allies will come in. Well, maybe some Iraqis will step forward and run their government, but it was not well thought out. There was actually a retired lieutenant general named Jake Garner, who'd been involved with the Kurds in 91, you know, helping do relief operations. Yeah. And he ran a brief organization under the Department of Defense that was supposed to handle reconstruction. But as you mentioned, he was deposed by Ambassador Jerry Bremer, who had a strong background in Europe. He'd worked in the Netherlands and all that, but really was not an Arabist, didn't know the region very well, and came in with a preconceived notion, not necessarily a bad historical analogy, but not appropriate. He remembered that in World War II, when the United States took over Germany in 1945 after Hitler shot himself and the Germans surrendered, he remembered that the United States had done something called denazification, where basically all the senior members of the SS and the Gestapo and the Nazi Party were all barred from giving government. In fact, in many cases, were investigated, rounded up, tried at places like Nuremberg. He saw a similar pattern at work in Iraq, but you know, that's an analogy, but he didn't think through the ramifications, because in Iraq, everybody who was an officer in the army, a school teacher, a person who ran the local power station, pretty much anybody who was anybody with an education was a member of the Ba'athist Party. So when you disband the army and the police and the intel services and the Ba'athist Party, you basically kicked out all the people who run the country for good or for ill.
Yeah.
And you've given these people every incentive in the world to now turn against the occupation authorities, because you essentially disenfranchised them. And in many cases, these are people who were figuring, oh, well, you know, they'll turn to us to run the country now. You know, so probably the right idea in a moral sense, you know, get these evil Ba'athist guys out of here, but not thought through in a practical sense. A person who knew the region better would have warned Ambassador Bremer, hey, you're going too far down. You probably need to get rid of the big guns, you know, the guys around Saddam, but the lesser fry, you need to be more reasonable about it. We weren't. And as a result, these people in many cases were Sunni Arabs, so they were already upset that the Shia majority was going to take over the government after there'd be an election. And now, you know, they're disenfranchised. They lose their jobs. And worse, the other people didn't know how to run all this stuff. So you got nobody to run the ministries and everything, you know, everything in Ba'athist Iraq, it was a socialist country, so it's centrally administered. So if your power system breaks down, your fuel system, both to export and to even have fuel within your country. So you have the second largest oil reserves in the world, and people can't get fuel for their generators or cars. I mean,
true.
It's just crazy.
And you didn't even things like garbage collection. I mean,
no, there was none. Yeah, until, you know, I mean, we had to rebuild all that.
Yeah.
And of course, when there's no garbage collection, it's more than an eyesore. I mean, there's health implications. Mm-hmm. I mean, that climate over there is immensely hot and humid along the rivers. So every type of disease you can imagine begins to propagate. And, you know, in our military, again, not with enough people, because Rumsfeld said, oh, send in a light footprint. Our military is trying to figure out how to sort all this out and do it in a way that they haven't really thought through. You know, we've got tanks, we've got jet fighters. Those aren't really good at getting rid of garbage.
Yeah, true. Yeah, and you also, speaking of not thinking it through, you've got some interesting insights on that whole USS Abraham Lincoln and the mission accomplished sign that's become kind of, you know, even in pop culture, it's made reference to quite a bit about how that came about. I was wondering if you could say a few words about that.
Yeah. Again, one of these things, you know, one of the things I try to do in the book is talk about things people think they know about the war that really aren't quite what you think. So the USS Abraham Lincoln, U.S. aircraft carrier, had actually done one of the longest deployments in modern U.S. naval history. The normal Navy deployment at that time was 6 months. The Lincoln had been out for almost nine. They'd sent strikes in to help in Afghanistan. They did the strikes to help in Iraq. And so the battle group was coming home. And the sailors put up a sign on the bridge, you know, on the island of the carrier that said mission accomplished. They were talking about the Lincoln's mission and the battle group mission. When Bush's people found out about it, now Bush, of course, former fighter pilot from the Air National Guard during Vietnam era and stuff, you know, he knew how to fly a plane and, you know, and all that. So they put him in a flight suit and put him in a Navy jet, and he's going to land on the carrier, which is very exciting, I'm sure. But they saw this sign up there, and his people were like, yeah, that's good. That's, you know, leave it up there. It looks good. You know, in retrospect, I mean, it became a punchline because the president, in his speech, if you read his speech, he thanks the troops, which is great, but particularly thanks the sailors of the Lincoln Battle Group, also great. He says in there, hey, the first fight, you know, the conventional fight, the fight to seize Baghdad is over, but the war continues. We've got a lot of work to do. It's going to be a long war. Nobody heard that part. All they saw was the image of him in front of a sign that said mission accomplished and the part where he said the fight is over. And you know, boy, he paid for that politically for years. And as you said, it still is. I mean, I can remember Keith Olbermann every night would say, you know, X number of days since mission accomplishment, you know, and I think everybody in America had heard that.
Oh, yeah, that goofy television show that people either love or hated, Arrested Development. They made a field day making references to that moment of the war.
I think what it gets at, this is something that's noteworthy. You know, the United States is a country that can sell you either Pepsi or Coke, which are basically sugared soft drinks, and convince you they're totally different products. And if you like one, you can't like the other. I mean, we can sell you almost anything. And yet we did a terrible job, you know, quote, selling the ideas behind this war. We're not very good at propaganda. You know, we're real good at selling products. But when it comes to explaining why our government does what it does, we have a lot of ham-handed images like what we've just talked about here. We don't think it through very well.
It's a good point. Before we get to the surge, another point on your book I found interesting is when you took on the issues of WMDs in Iraq, and you make an argument that doesn't always get emphasized in the books I've read about the war. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you write about WMDs.
Yeah. Well, I felt validated by the New York Times, who dug into some of the same stuff I'd seen in theater when working with my folks. And that is that the Iraqis had a chemical capability. They had a little bit of nuclear research and a little bit of bio research, but they had a chemical capability that they used on their own people, they used it on the Iranians, and they had the residual rounds left. But the whole Iraqi industrial base was in ruins basically after the first go around with them in 1991. And they weren't really able to rebuild it for a lot of reasons in the 90s. In some cases they didn't choose to. So those weapons were still out there and had to be rounded up and picked up and all that kind of stuff. There was a tendency because we did not find, you know, I think people thought they were going to find like almost like something out of a James Bond movie where there'd be this underground lair with all these lined up missiles with, you know, with a hazmat warning on the nose cone, and they'd be all, you know, you'd be dialed in for New York and Paris and all that. Nothing like that was there. It was very ramshackle, but so was all of Iraq. So was their army. So was their navy. So, I mean, their air force, they were burying planes in the desert rather than flying against our air force. And so a residual chemical capability was there. How quickly could he reconstitute it? We don't know, but it would be wrong to say, hey, they had nothing. There were no WMDs. And to the credit of the reporters at the New York Times, they laid this out really well this summer. You know, again, it took them a while to get access to all the sources that told them that.
Yeah.
But, you know, for U.S. domestic political reasons, there were a lot of people who wanted to say, hey, you told us there were WMDs, you being Bush. You told us there were WMDs, there weren't any, therefore you lied and all that. But in theater, we always knew they had something. It just wasn't the high degree that we had thought there might be going in.
Sure. I was going to raise the issue of the surge, but even before we get there, I think it's important that you describe. You can comment on it if you want. There's horrific violence, you know, goes into Iraq, 2004, 2005, 2006, bombings, Sacred Shia Mosque, the Al-Askari and Samarra.
Right, Samarra.
Yes, I mean, and eventually what happens is, you know, you get the political pressure, the 2006 elections, and then you see what you refer to in the book as Sawa, the Sunni awakening, and you begin to see right. Sunnis react and arm themselves against Al-Qaeda and begin to, not all Sunnis, of course, but you begin to see many Sunnis taking up the war effort. And that's obviously, I think, a very important moment in the war. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners more about
absolutely.
That.
absolutely pivotal. And this happened, I think, partially because what Iraq again split between three major groups: Kurdish, who are Islamic but are not Arab, and then two Arab groups: a minority that's Sunni Arab, a majority that's Shia Arab. Two different sects of Islam, the two primary sects. Not exact analog, but think of it as like Catholic, Protestant, or whatever in the Christian world. But those two sects, the Sunnis, who are the minority, had been the core of the insurgency. They were the ones that Saddam had favored. He was a Sunni Arab. He had favored them. With him out, they are the outs now. And as we talked about, Bremer and others had basically put him on the outs and kicked him out of all the key positions of influence and such. So they're the enemy to the American occupation forces, and also to the new regime in Baghdad that's headed by the Shia. Well, Al-Qaeda thought, you know, hey, we are also Sunni Arabs. We'll be your organizers. You guys are a bunch of disparate groups, various tribes and clans and families. We'll take charge and we'll run the show for you because we know what's best for you. And they went out into these rural villages out in the farmlands of western and northern Iraq and began imposing things that were very, very strict Sharia law. The average sheikh out there likes to race horses. He likes to buy an occasional nip of booze from the Christians in Baghdad. He likes to bet on things. He likes to smoke cigarettes. And these guys were out ruling all this out. Moreover, a lot of them have daughters who they want to send places like Jordan and such to be educated. No. According to Al-Qaeda, you don't educate women at all. You keep them barefoot and pregnant. Well, these sheikhs who had been, you know, they were the descendants of people who had ruled these regions for centuries. They were essentially said, hey, you are imposing on our authority and our local rule. We've had enough of this. We may not care much for the regime in Baghdad, but these Americans here who are here right now, we might cut a deal with them temporarily to fight you because you are in our villages causing day-to-day trouble and killing us and chopping off hands and doing all that kind of stuff. We might make a pact with these infidels to deal with you. And that became the awakening, the Salah. And awakening Salah is an interesting word. It gets translated into English as Sunni awakening or whatever, but it's the best way to translate it would essentially be a rude awakening, like, you know, splashing cold water in your face. Like, boy, we finally woke up, you know, and realized we were doing something crazy dealing with Al-Qaeda. We need to get in with somebody else.
Yeah. And that's,
and that, by the way, started in 05. You know, it did not start with the surge in 07. That started in 05.
Oh, absolutely.
The first groups began to come in.
Yes, I agree. And what ends up happening is you begin to, you know, the Sunnis take up, you know, take it up against or take up arms against Al-Qaeda. And then, you know, when the idea of the 2006 elections, and then you move toward the surge. And when you discuss the surge, I think you make a number of important points about how it wasn't popular among many military leaders. And it had to come.
Not at all.
Yeah. And it had to, you know, Bush had to make the decision after consulting with a wide variety of people. And also, when I'd like you to say, talk about the surge, but when you raise the issue, it also involves grappling with General Petraeus and kind of where he fits into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Well, the surge in General Petraeus, really, you know, he is the mind behind the surge. He's the one senior military guy on active duty who strongly argued for a surge. Most of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the service chiefs, the theater commanders, the field commanders, all to a man said, don't surge. We got what we got. Let's ride it out. You know, the Iraqis are either going to make it or not going to make it. Don't double down on this deal. Petraeus was one of the guys who said, no, you need to send in more U.S. troops as a signal of resolve. We need to gain some control over Baghdad. We need to tamp down this insurgency and give the Iraqis a chance to get themselves together. And that was done. And he was, you know, as the British would say, he was the man of the match. He was the guy who went in and pulled that all off. The challenge was, of course, the surge was temporary by its nature. A surge is like a wave coming up on the beach. It's going to wash out. Well, back to one of our main problems. Who's the enemy and what happens next? We didn't think through what would happen when the United States began to wash out. What happens to our new Salah allies, our Sunni allies, when they realize the Americans are leaving? What happens to the enemy when they realize the Americans are leaving? Who fills this vacuum? Is the Iraqi government ready to fill this vacuum? The answer, no, as we've seen with the rise of ISIS. All ISIS is, when they came in, it's the old Sunni insurgency. It's the same guys. And in the cases like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he's literally the same guy we were chasing around in the 2010-11 period. So the surge gets a lot of, it works in a temporary sense, but it is strictly that, a temporary surge. And Petraeus will then step up to the old Tommy Frank's job, Central Command, where he sees both Afghanistan and Iraq under his command. A guy named General Stan McChrystal will lead the surge in Afghanistan, but it is Petraeus who comes in and has to carry that out as the Afghan commander after McChrystal's relief for saying some intemperate things to a Rolling Stone reporter.
I definitely want to talk about that.
Petraeus is the guy. He's the dominant figure. But he's a very controversial figure in the U.S. military, I can tell you that. He is he's an exceedingly ambitious guy. He's very able and capable, but you always wonder, whose agenda is being used here.
True. And you bring that ambivalence out very well about his position, of being kind.
But we have to give him credit for what he accomplished. Commander at a time of some accomplishment.
No doubt. And he was treated pretty unfairly by a lot of anti-war groups, I would throw in there.
Oh, yeah, horribly. Yes. When he went to testify in Congress, MoveOn.org in particular ran a big ad that did a pun on his name and said, General Betray Us.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just way out of bounds. I mean, he was coming to testify for Congress. You could agree or disagree with the policy, but that guy is not a treasonous guy. And to suggest that is terrible.
Yeah. So as far as, as events unwind in Iraq, 2008, 2009 into 2010, I was wondering if you could kind of, say something about the Iraqi government that we were, leaving behind to pick up the ball, as it were, and, create a functioning country, especially Prime Minister Maliki. You say a lot about him in the book.
Nouri al-Maliki is unfortunately in the long line of bad apples that the United States has picked up. I mean, you could go to Dien Bien Phu in South Vietnam, the Somoza family in Nicaragua, the Ramos family in the Philippines, Karzai in Afghanistan, who's of the same ilk. He was, the classic, he's an SOB, but he's our SOB type guy. He was strongly affiliated with the Iranians, really had no time for the Sawa, the Sunni Arabs. One of the things was the Sunni Arabs had come in thinking they'd get a role in the government now. They'd been disenfranchised by Bremer during the occupation period early on. And they thought, oh, this guy Maliki will let us get in and we can vote and we can elect people and we can have a role in the government. Nope, Maliki was all about taking care of his Shia buddies. He basically manufactured a result of it with our looking aside in the 2010 election, which he did not win. In fact, he came in second in that election. We looked aside as he changed the results, did recounts, worthy of anything that happened in Florida in 2000, and basically reinstalled himself as prime minister. He was about to do it a third time this year, but President Obama and everybody finally just said, enough is enough. You do it one more time, that's it. You were pulling everything and you're on your own. And his Dawa party wised up, and that's why he got Haider al-Abadi in there right now, because they realized another go-around with Maliki wasn't going to work. But he a very, very shady, self-serving guy. Bad news.
True. That's my read of it, too. I think it's a good time to transition to the final part of your book where you deal with the war in Afghanistan. And a couple of things caught my attention in this section, especially, you go through the military operations and battles and, fighting in places like, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Barji-Matal in the Nuristan province.
Barji-Matal.
Yes.
Yeah, up in the mountains. Yes.
In Marja, an operation, Mashtarak.
Yep, down in the southwest.
Yes. What struck me about this is I kind of picked this up, but not as much as when after I read or as I should have before reading the book, is how much restraint that the United States military forces used in exercising firepower, especially under McChrystal.
General McChrystal. Yeah.
I mean, lives were lost and people realized this. And he, he went on that one mission. I can't remember where exactly it was. He went out with that unit where one of the staff sergeants.
Yeah, west of Kandahar.
Yes, west of Kandahar. And so that struck me that, because you get a feel for this in other books about all the kind of paperwork and bureaucracy. If you thought, there were Taliban members and you wanted to get permission to have an airstrike or artillery, if there was any chance of civilian deaths, that was not approved. at one point you have to, like, literally soldiers were told not to initiate fire if they thought there was any chance of civilian casualties.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, I don't want to kill civilians ever, you know? And, but you gotta be reasonable about this. I talked to plenty of Afghan civilians and they would tell you they knew it was a war. The Taliban intentionally entrenched themselves in villages. They did that on purpose. When we disarmed ourselves by saying, oh, we won't do this, you know, to me, one of the basic military principles is you got to trust the person on the ground. You know, General Stan McChrystal, who is a great hero, and he's the unsung hero of the war because he's the guy who trained our special ops how to do manhunting. When they get bin Laden, those are the techniques that McChrystal devised when he was in charge of the special forces. But when he comes to be the conventional commander in Afghanistan, I think he forgot that he wasn't with special forces anymore, who have excellent intel and who always have good target data and who always have the top equipment and the top training and stuff. Now he's dealing with a large number of forces that are spread out across the whole country, don't always have great intel. And the old rule is you trust the person on the ground. And to me, but another way to approach it, rather than issue all these top down orders, you know, saying you can't do this, you got to do this, you got to check with dad to do this, this and this, you know, shoot artillery, fly an airstrike, go into a village or whatever. A better solution would have been to give intent and say, hey, my intention is to limit civilian casualties. You guys do your best. And if you have a subordinate commander who doesn't get it, you get a new subordinate commander. The military allows you to replace commanders who don't follow, you know, those approaches. In Iraq, we never, you know, we also worked among a civil population and we never had those kind of restraints. But I was amazed when, you know, started dealing with Afghanistan, but what we had done to ourselves. We thought we were making Karzai happy because he would complain about all this kind of stuff. Karzai, of course, a guy who also stole an election in 2009, one he did not win, that we looked the other way while he stuffed the ballot box and stole that one. But we gave him way too much credence. I mean, the average Afghan that I talked to, the village elders and imams and stuff, when I talked to them, they say, hey, it's a war. We understand. You know, we'd rather have you go after the Taliban. We realize you're going to be as careful as you can. But, you know, they also realized the nature of that type of war, there were going to be civilians killed. And the Taliban killed more of them than we did. But, you know, they weren't apologizing. No,
those weren't the images on Al Jazeera and other, I mean, even Western news outlets, you know, certainly.
Well, and it goes, yes, it goes back to, did we think through how we present the narrative of our war? We did not. Mm-hmm. Instead, we didn't give that much thought at all. In the case of our enemies, though, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the Sunni insurgents in Iraq, they thought about that first. Before they even mounted an operation, they thought about how will this be portrayed? Because for them, they had to get the imagery right or they would not get recruits and money to keep their movement going.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing that comes through in your analysis, I mean, it's great stuff to read about the reparations game and how, you know, the issue of civilian casualties would, you know, some turn into apologies that Karzai showed no appreciation for in general. And then, you know, the money that would be taken, especially from America's allies in the war. And it just kind of this cycle of, you know, civilian casualties, maybe some were true, some were not, and money being taken and false reports. I wonder if you could, you know, add some details to that.
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, the United States, the tradition in the Pashtun code, the Pashtun people, Karzai was a Pashtun, they're about 40% of the Afghan population, but they have a code called Pashtun Wali. And like many peoples in the world have, they had the idea of blood money, that if someone was killed by accident, you know, not a murderer, not intentional, but if someone was killed by accident, you know, and that would include a bomb that dropped off target or a person shot by a stray round or something, you owed their family blood money. And that would then ensure there was no feud that would go on for generations. And so the United States accepted this and paid what they called, you know, a salation payment or a compensation payment if someone was killed, reparations, if you will. And we would come in and pay a certain amount if, you know, if someone was killed. We would even pay if their livestock was killed or their house was damaged, all these different things. And our local commanders had various degrees of authority to pay certain amounts of money. But what began to happen, and you sure can't blame the Afghans for this, I mean, it's the fourth poorest country in the world, they began to see this as a bit of a racket. So whenever there'd be an Allied operation in their area, they would show up the next day at the U.S. camp and they'd say, well, you know, three goats were killed, and also my daughter, I would like $X thousand. And you were in a position, you know, how much are you going to investigate that? Well, you could go down in the village, but that means mounting a patrol, potentially getting shot up, all that kind of stuff. Or you could just take the guy and pay it. Well, we're a rich country. We mostly paid it. And it got kind of crazy because Karzai then would insist on a public apology by our field commander, you know, in that case, General McChrystal, later General Allen, later General Dunford, now General Campbell. You know, they'd insist on a public apology for some of these incidents. And then they would also stick their hand out for money at each of the echelons of government. And what also began to happen, the Taliban, not being stupid, you know, they all wear civilian clothes. So guess what they started doing? They started reporting their casualties. And because we didn't want to investigate or cause a stink or make a big deal, we ended up paying the death gratuities to the Taliban as well in some cases. And I mean, okay, you know, the Taliban's got to be happy now, because if you got your opponent basically paying your, you're paying off your life insurance for you, I mean, you can't beat that.
Yeah, it's not a bad policy at all. And it reminds me of another issue that you do a great job of drawing attention to. It's the prisoners that were the U.S. and their allies would capture and hand over to Afghans, and they would, you know, go through prisons very quickly. And sometimes, if I remember one part of the book correctly, it was they'd go before essentially judges or some type of tribunal and would say something like, "I promise not to kill people anymore," and they would just be let off, and you'd see them, you know, fighting, you know, very soon after that.
Yeah, but our troops called it catch and release, you know, like with fish. And but what they would do, they would actually go into the Islamic, you know, the court for the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, and they would say, "Hey, I did kill people, but I only killed the Americans and their infidels." And they'd say, "Well, that's fine, as long as you don't kill any Afghans, okay, out you go." You
know? Yes.
I mean, and to us, we would say, "You got to be crazy. We were paying for that court," and yet, you know, that's what they were delivering. I mean, and the very idea that. You know, Afghanistan is a country that has 85% adult illiteracy. The idea that these guys, a few years after, you know, we've come in there, somehow can run a court system and stuff. I mean, we were very overly ambitious thinking that could happen and we'd get any other result than that. But it definitely didn't work in our favor.
Yeah, and that's your point, right, is a good segue to where you kind of go with your analysis of Afghanistan. I mean, you certainly, I'm not going to draw that much attention to the interview, but it's a very interesting read on far the effects of warfare on the U.S. soldiers kind of being out there in the heat, you know, far away from civilization. Some of the, you refer to it as Le Cafard, you kind of compare it to the French legionaries. And that's very gut-wrenching reading.
We see it. Yeah, we see it, you know, we see it with the veterans. I mean, the reason wars like Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan breed a lot of psychological and psychiatric problems is you've asked a young man or woman, you know, at age 18 to 22 to carry a weapon, go into a village, and try and sort out which guy's a farmer and which guy's a terrorist when they're all dressed alike, they all talk alike, and basically, you're fighting this war essentially in people's homes. You're fighting among their children. You're fighting among their personal belongings, you know, their bedding, their toys, all that. Kind of, I mean, that's a wrenching way to fight. I mean, all war is difficult, but that type of war is particularly hard. And so you spend a lot of time after it's over thinking, did I shoot the right guy? Did I shoot the wrong guy? You don't know because you don't speak their language. And if they're dead, they can't tell you.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, I had a semi-incident when I was teaching a class on the Vietnam War, and I didn't really think about it. I had a student who was a veteran from the Iraq War. I can't remember where he was stationed, but I started showing pictures of some battles, some search and destroy missions, and he just lost it. And I felt so bad about it, but I didn't even think about it. And your book reminded me of like the psychological scars of such a, you know, he's probably 22 years old, 23 years old, and it certainly was, you know, an eye opener for me. Something I should have been more sensitive to before I showed these clips in class.
I've definitely learned it. I've learned it myself, and my family definitely knows it. I mean, there's some stuff with me that they don't want me to look at. Let's put it that way. And and I'm an older guy who had a lot more experience than these very young privates and corporals who were there. So it is. It's very wrenching. It's very emotional. I mean, you're losing people. You're killing people. And both of those things are very corrosive. And over time, if you don't talk about it and you don't think about it, it'll eat you up.
Yes, definitely. And another, when you see how the part three unfolds, you raise a number of issues that kind of get to the core of the book as far as who is the enemy and how do you measure success as part of this. And what strikes me about the stuff about your analysis of the war in Afghanistan is how it switched to, you know, a war of attrition as the measure of progress. You've got all these other things going on with nation building, and you know, you talk about General Allen with his, you know, with his presentations, you know, going through all sorts of statistics for progress. But at the end of the day, you know, the surge that the Obama administration, you know, agrees to, at the, it boiled down to is just a simple war of attrition, biding time until U.S. troops could get out. And I guess my question is, you know, at the end of the day, how, you know, what went right and what went wrong with, you know, how the U.S. approached the war in Afghanistan?
Well, there's, in my view, you're right about the war of attrition in numbers. There's an old, you know, thing they say when you deal with data, and that's garbage in, garbage out. The really important numbers that you really wanted from Afghanistan would have come from the villagers and the enemy, and they didn't provide numbers. So everything was painted or skewed towards what the Americans thought was happening. And it's very, very risky in this type of war to sit in the headquarters and look at numbers and think you're really seeing anything. You've got to get out on the ground and look around. And when you do, you see quite a different and more sobering view than whatever the numbers may say. You know, what went right, what went wrong? What went right, I think, is that, you know, we got our military into both countries, both Iraq and Afghanistan, and did well in the initial operation and knocked out those enemy governments, you know, cleaned out al-Qaeda very quickly in Afghanistan. We did that, and that was done effectively by December of 2001 and was done effectively by about April or May of 2003 in Iraq. That's what our military is good at, is that kind of an operation, a rapid, decisive operation, you know, a fairly inventive one using special ops and air power in Afghanistan, a version of Desert Storm with tanks and everything in Iraq. It's when we stayed after that we went wrong. We didn't think through, okay, who do we hand this off to, and what are we willing to accept as an outcome? Well, since we didn't work that through, we left our people there. And as we left our people there, suddenly insurgencies pop up in both countries very rapidly in Iraq. And then over time, the Taliban reinserted themselves in Afghanistan. And in both cases, we were now in an insurgency. The military understood that. That's why, you know, you have the surge. You have guys like General Petraeus who, you know, introduced some ideas of counterinsurgency theory that go back, you know, not even just to Vietnam, but go way back in history, you know, back to even, you know, stuff that was done in the Philippines in the early 1900s, all that kind of stuff. Well, great. But, you know, do we ever have the discussion? We do not. With the American people, with their elected and appointed representatives, that says, hey, once you've accepted counterinsurgency in these countries led by Americans, you've just signed on for a 50-year war. Are you guys okay with that? That discussion was never had. No. And, of course, the reality was neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration was okay with that. Very important to note that the agreement to withdraw from Iraq, they beat up the current president a lot over that, but the agreement to withdraw from Iraq was signed in December 2008 by our ambassador, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, good guy, great diplomat, also wrote a similar agreement with the Karzai government in Afghanistan and copied it almost word for word from the Iraq one. But the title of that agreement from 2008 was the Agreement on the Withdrawal of U.S. Forces from Iraq. And, you know, to then somehow imply, well, when we pulled everybody out in 2011, you know, this was a big awakening. It's like that was the plan from the previous administration. Because neither administration wanted to sign up for a 50-year war.
You raise an interesting point, and kind of once it also gets to the heart of your book, you know, I've read you did a piece in an op-ed piece in the New York Times and some other forums where you're very hard on the military leadership as far as the advice and recommendations that they gave civilian authorities. I mean, the stereotypical view of war and the military is, you know, go back to Vietnam or Korea, that, you know, if only the short-sighted politicians would let the military do what it does, we wouldn't have these problems. But you take a much different view in the book, and I was wondering if you could just elaborate.
Christian, I'm a military guy, and I know what advice we gave them. They basically followed a lot of our advice. Okay. I mean, I mentioned in the surge, a large number of people were against it. But General David Petraeus, who's a senior commander, he was for it. So was a retired general named General Jack Keane, Vietnam veteran, also a very articulate guy who'd been the vice chief of staff, the second in charge of the army at the start of the war. I mean, there were several guys who advocated for the surge. You know, the point that I'm getting at is the military advice that was given was followed for the most part. It was bad advice. You know, what we didn't have was that discussion where we say, how long are you willing to stay in these countries? Mm-hmm. How many resources do you want to commit? Do you understand that if you leave Americans as the preeminent force in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you're going to have 100,000 of us there for 20 or 30 years. Is that okay with you? Or do you want us to come up with an alternate plan? Interestingly enough, the U.S. military never came up with an alternate strategy to that basic village counterinsurgency. There were other alternatives. We could have withdrawn our forces. We could have gone to a situation where we put more of them in charge, like the Vietnamization program in South Vietnam. It did not work, but it was a plan. We could have gone to what Vice President Biden suggested, which was a special operations focused, counterterrorism mission in either country. Vice President Biden, I might ask, also note that he and Leslie Gelb, when Biden was a senator, came up with an idea of maybe splitting Iraq into three parts, like the Ottomans had done, have a Kurdish part, Sunni part, Shia part. Those kind of alternate strategies were not proposed. Instead, the military essentially gave the following options to the senior leadership. You can send less troops, the same number of troops, or more troops. I mean, that's not really an option. That's, you know, we've agreed that we're going to follow this flawed strategy, and your only choice is how much are you going to follow it? Yeah. I mean, that's not really very good military advice.
No.
And we go to war colleges and stuff to learn better than that. I mean, I know I know better than that. But really, in a way, Christian, we were undone by our own early success. Because we did well, unexpectedly well in both countries at the start of the war, and because we have a great all-volunteer military, wonderful young men and women who are very capable and are willing to try whatever we give them, we actually thought, well, you know, our military is so good now, maybe we can pull off this Vietnam thing, and this time it'll work out. And that was tremendously short-sighted.
Yeah, and you make that case very effectively. And I guess as a way, I mean, I've taken so much of your time today with this interview, but I think it's a good point to talk about what lessons we've learned, unlearned about, you know, warfare based on, our experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how we should, you know, use military forces and organize military forces for the threats we face, as diverse as ISIS or ISIL in the Middle East, or more conventional threats like, say, Russia or possibly even China.
Right. Or, you know, North Korea. There's plenty of them.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there are.
I think what we need to... Yeah, what we need to recognize is what our military is good at and what we're not good at. The U.S. military is real good at a short, decisive operation against the conventional enemy. You put us head-to-head against guys who have tanks and artillery and jet fighters and submarines and all that, we'll clean them up every time. And we work hard at that. We train hard at that. It's not cheap. We have good weapons, excellent training and education, and highly selected and trained young men and women who do that stuff. So we're good at that. Our enemy knows that. So that's why they choose to confront us with these irregular forces, with people like ISIS and stuff like that. If we're going to go against them, we sort of got to swallow hard, and we got to really look at our other options. One option is to do nothing. And sometimes that's really hard for a superpower, but sometimes you got to step back and just say, hey, I can't fix this. This is, you know, it's your thing. You're going to have to do it. Another, which is what President Obama and his administration have adopted in Iraq and Syria, is to give limited support, carefully limited support to the local forces, in this case, the Iraqis, and if we can ever find any, moderate Syrians, and they would carry the weight of the battle on the ground. We'd supply some airstrikes, some intel, some training and advice, and maybe some supplies. That's a long, long, frustrating strategy of containment, but it's certainly preferable to 100,000 Americans on the ground, because you start putting 100,000 Americans on the ground, the clock starts running, and the American people rightly expect a result from that. And so those are some of the initial lessons from a military perspective. It does look like the military is figuring that out, but, you know, we'll see. It remains to be seen how things go in Iraq, and I do think that when spring comes in Afghanistan, we're going to be in a crisis there as well, because the Taliban is quite resurgent, and once the weather breaks, they'll be back on the battlefield and active.
And there's so many unknowables about Afghanistan with Karzai, going out of office, and what's going to happen. In the recent foreign affairs issue, some of the articles, I won't name names, seem they're very for lack of a better term, hopeful about the future of Afghanistan in terms of development of civil society, and that the Taliban won't, you know, be a long-term threat in the sense that it's going to, you know, topple the entire country. Yeah. It's not like, you know, roses, you know, fields of poppy, or that was a bad way of putting it, seeds or fields of poppy.
There's plenty of fields of poppy.
Yes, I meant fields of roses with people galloping and skipping, but they seem to think that, you know, it's generally in the going in the right direction. I don't know if it sounds a little rosy to me.
Absolutely crazy to think that. I mean, look at the history of that country. It is one of the most unhappy places in the world. Never centrally governed with any effect from Kabul. The best you ever had was a figurehead there during the, you know, the King's Zahir era or something like that. I mean, look, part of it is they're all enthralled with Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai because he speaks good English and taught at Berkeley and went to Columbia and everything. Look, Ghani's a good guy. He's a nice guy and everything. But, you know, he's going to go his own route. And, you know, the fact that he seems westernized is something I might add was what was Karzai's strength when we put him forward.
Well, it's,
you know, let's see what Ghani does once the spring comes and the Taliban are active in the south and east. You know, then we'll see how this government hangs together. I'm not optimistic because, you know, the Taliban are out there and these guys don't have any capability to get rid of.
Yeah. And another thing, you raise a point, and I'm once again, I'm taking a lot of your time, but there's so much fascinating stuff in this book, is this idea of winning hearts and minds. And how do you win hearts and minds if you don't really know what the people think? One of the points in your book about judging progress against the Taliban and in the hearts and minds of the people in Afghanistan is if you don't speak the language, you don't know the customs, the warfare is hard. I mean, how do you win the hearts and minds if you can't? You know, you have this great section of the book where you talk about, and I reread it before the interview, about just talking, sending people in, even people, you know, native Afghanistan, you know, not interpreters, but poll takers who, you know, essentially ask questions about the future and they don't even understand. They tend to give answers that they think the poll people want to hear. And whether they may not believe it or not, they may say everything's good and then, you know, actually have links to the Taliban. And how do you get around that basic problem, winning the hearts and minds? I don't know what the answer is to that.
Well, I personally think for an outsider like the Americans, the only way we're going to win hearts and minds in these countries is to be temporary, to be in support rather than in the lead, to, you know, to assist them in the areas we can, but to understand it's got to be their solution. Nobody in no country, whether the United States or anything, likes some foreign guy coming in and telling them how to do stuff, even when they come with resources. And I think that's the challenge in Afghanistan. You have a village culture that's existed for centuries. And, you know, a bunch of Americans showing up with a big bag of money and the ability to dig a well or build a school, you know, that doesn't necessarily help with what they want. You know, rather than me showing up with the money and saying, hey, I'm going to dig you a well, I'm going to build you a school. Think of it if we showed up instead and say, what do you want? What would you like done? And how can I help you guys with what you might want? Because they might turn to you and say, we're not interested at all in education, but we'd like something to deal with this disease that's afflicting our sheep, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's the way to do it. And to understand that the Afghan government itself has to win the hearts and minds. We, you know, in some ways, we displaced the governments of Afghanistan and Iraq. We certainly did with the Salwa in Iraq, to where the locals were trusting us more than their own government. Well, the problem is when you then pull out the Americans, they don't trust their government. And that means open season for the insurgents because they can come in and fill that gap.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's difficult questions. And once again, you know, thank you for taking so much time to speak with me about your book. And in conclusion, I was wondering if you could tell the listeners about what your future plans might be as far as scholarship or teaching or any other endeavors.
Well, I'm fortunate to be here at North Carolina State University in the Center of the Research Triangle. So we have Duke, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, all those. And we do a lot of things here, seminars that affect all three of those major universities and several other colleges in the region. So my goal is to keep working with students and keep the discussion going. And then as far as future research, I want to continue to write. I think I'm going to move past this current war. I thought about it and I need to give it a break for a little bit and maybe go back a little bit further into the past and look at some other things in history. But I think I'll stay on the military angle. I've spent most of my life doing that. And there's always more to learn about people and, you know, why they fight and what they can do maybe to prevent it.
Yeah, true. That is, it's an interesting way of putting it. I talked with, I did an interview a couple weeks ago with Henry Arnau from George Washington, a polyscientist, and he talked a lot about kind of, you know, a line of scholarship of trying to figure out, you know, how ideas constrain how we behave or how we don't behave, and how we kind of look at, essentially, we look at courses of action based on the assumptions that we have, and how that influence potentially influences war and peace. Because I think a lot of the times when American policymakers and get into war, peace issues, their assumptions, they're kind of what they see as, you know, legitimate or non-legitimate, definitely color it. Anywhere from Lyndon Johnson to George Bush to the advice that military policymakers give, certainly there's kind of a frame of reference when you have certain assumptions that leaves out, you know, courses of action that could perhaps produce different results. So that is an interesting topic to think about. So, General Bolger, thank you for speaking with me. It's been a pleasure, and I would recommend you know, everyone to read this book. It's a longer book, obviously, but it's a quick read. It's very straightforward. It's well written. I found myself not being able to put it down when I probably should have been spending more time grading student papers a little quicker than I you know probably did. But yes, it's an excellent work, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. You have been listening to Christian Peterson interview General Daniel Bolger on New Books in World Affairs. We hope you drop by in the near future. Have an excellent day.